Good morning, everyone. I want to go ahead and plug this evening's lesson before we go into this morning's for you, just so you know what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be asking a question about unconditional forgiveness. It's an interesting topic. When we try to figure out, do I need to forgive somebody if they're not sorry? If they didn't ask for forgiveness, if they haven't repented at all, what are my obligations? And actually, it's a fairly complicated question, the way that you're going to answer that. But we need to talk about what forgiveness is and some of the differences in how God forgives and we forgive. And it should all be very interesting. I hope you'll be back here at 5 o'clock for that. It's a useful topic for us to consider, because conflict resolution is something that we end up having to deal with more often than we should, maybe. But it's a good skill to have, and it's something that is very practical for us. So I wanted to tell you about that for tonight's lesson, so that you would know to be here at 5 o'clock for that and be prepared mentally for that discussion. This morning, though, we're going to be studying from Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. This is when Jesus raises the dead in the town of Nain. And I've titled this lesson, Compassion and Power, because that's what I think this account shows. It shows Jesus' compassion toward those who are in a low state, toward those who are suffering. And it shows his power as he raises the dead. But there's some interesting things for us to consider. Let's go ahead and read Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17, and we'll talk about it. Soon afterward, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a considerable crowd from the town was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came up and touched the bier, and the bearer stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. This is not the most well-known of Jesus' miracles. If we're going to look at Jesus raising someone from the dead, we usually look at Lazarus. It's such a powerful account, and there's all sorts of details in there that make that really meaningful. Some of the other miracles that Jesus worked are maybe a little bit flashier, or the account is just a little bit longer, and so there are more details for us to consider. But this one is important, I think. It's important because of its simplicity, and it's important because of a contrast that is made, or a comparison. It's not exactly a contrast, but a comparison that is made with some events that happened in the past, back years and years before this ever happened. And so the first thing for us to consider with this account is how Jesus met sorrow with compassion. Jesus is traveling, and he approaches the small town of Nain, and there's a funeral procession in progress. A young man had died, leaving his widowed mother alone. And it's always a tragedy when someone dies. It's especially a tragedy when a parent has to bury a child, even an adult child, like this. But there's an extra dose of tragedy here because the woman is left alone. His mother is left with no one to support her. This is her only son, and she is a widow. And this is long before the days of Social Security and, you know, 401ks and these sorts of events, these sorts of mechanisms that we have to try to provide for people in their old age. The retirement plan in much of the world through much of history was work until you can't and then let your kids take care of you until you die. And when your husband dies younger than you would have liked, and your only son dies before you do, that doesn't leave you with a whole lot of options. And so the rest of her life is likely to be hard. She is going to rely on whatever that she has saved, whatever she is able to scrounge up herself, and the kindness and compassion of her community. This is not an unusual case. This happened fairly frequently. It's sad. It's difficult. And so it only adds to the sorrow that she felt. I don't want to make this purely a financial thing. Like, surely she was sorrowful because this is her son. There's enough sorrow there, obviously. But this is more complicated than just missing him. She is missing a lot of the support and structure that she needs as she goes into her older age. The community recognized the tragedy that had happened here, and many were present there at the funeral. So Jewish tradition makes it very likely that this funeral took place the same day as the young man's death. We don't so often do that today. We usually have a few days or maybe even a week or two from someone's death and then their funeral. But there are some pretty good reasons why they went ahead and did that quickly back then. They did have some embalming processes and some things similar to what we do. But even still, you wanted to go ahead and get that process started. Dead bodies need to be taken care of, need to be dealt with, to not cause a stink and to not be a health hazard. These are the things we don't like to think about with death, but it is a reality. The soul has left. The body is there just to decompose and just to fall apart. And so they often had these funerals the very same day. So this is all still very raw, very numb for her, I'm sure. And they are proceeding out of the city carrying this young man's body. Jesus had compassion on her, but he first expresses that in a way that would have been difficult to hear. I want you to imagine being this woman, this widow, who now is left all alone, and it's in the middle of the funeral procession, and some stranger walks up, and he says, "Do not weep." You go, "Excuse me. Who are you, and why are you telling me not to cry at my only son's funeral?" That would have been a fairly cruel thing to say from anyone else. But Jesus, you know, immediately balances that with something that shows that he's not there to be cruel. He's not saying that as a rebuke. Sometimes we tell people, "Stop crying," because their sorrow makes us uncomfortable. If you've said that to someone before, I'd encourage you to stop. It's not really a helpful thing to say much of the time. And sorrow needs to be expressed, usually. And it doesn't do any good to try to pass on my own discomfort with that person's sorrow by saying, "I would, you know, really be more comfortable if you just stopped." Jesus is not rebuking her like that. And he's not saying it as an empty platitude like we do sometimes, where we say, "Oh, there's nothing to be sad about. You should just be happy. He's gone on to a better place, and so if you don't have a smile plastered on your face, then there's something wrong with you." Well, that's not that helpful either. Even if somebody has gone on to a better place, there's still a time and a place for sorrow. And sorrow is appropriate in a time of loss. So don't mistake Jesus' statement for either one of these things. He's not rebuking her. He's not giving her an empty platitude. Instead, he is going to take away her reason for weeping. But I said that Jesus did something to balance out his bizarre statement, a statement that probably would not have been taken well if she had a moment to process it. As he comes up and he says that, he also reaches out and touches the bier, or your translation may say the coffin. That's bier, B-I-E-R, obviously. Now, you might be thinking a coffin, a casket like we do. Obviously, they did not have those elaborate caskets that we have today. most commonly, they put the dead body wrapped in cloth on a board, on a plank of wood, and carried the plank of wood out. It was pretty much just serviceable, something that allowed you to not have to immediately touch that body longer than necessary, and let you carry it out with some dignity outside the city so it could be buried. But yes, it's wrapped in cloth, and it's you know, processed and treated in some way, but mostly it is just a temporary measure to be able to get it to the tomb. So why does Jesus touch it? Why does Jesus reach out and touch that board, touch that plank of wood? There's a lot more meaning to that than you might think. The lesson is not that Jesus needs to be within physical touching distance of something in order to raise the dead. In fact, the story that comes right before this in Luke chapter 7 is the story of Jesus healing the centurion's servant. And the centurion comes to him and he says, my servant is gravely ill and I know who you are. I know that you have power and I beg of you, please heal him. And Jesus says, okay, I will go to your house and I will heal him. And the centurion says, I understand something about authority. I know that as a man with authority, I don't have to personally be somewhere for that thing that I commanded to get done. I'm a man of power, and so I can say, go here, go there, do this, do that, and it gets done. I know that you are a man of power as well, and so I know that you don't need to be physically present to heal my servant. And because of that, I don't want to waylay you. I don't want to distract you from your purpose and your journey any longer than necessary. Please just say the word, and I know that my servant will be healed. And Jesus is very impressed with this faith and with this knowledge that the centurion has. And so he pronounces it done. And they go back and find that the centurion's servant has been healed. So why then, in the very next account, does Luke make mention of the fact that Jesus reaches out and touches the board? He doesn't need to be that close. He doesn't even have to be in Nain at all. But this is not about the mechanics of Jesus expressing his power. This is about Jesus showing his compassion. There's a detail of the law of Moses that you need to understand to get the full implication of what Jesus is doing when he reaches out and touches that. Of course, we know there are all these laws of purity and cleanliness in the law of Moses, various things that you had to, you know, withdraw yourself from the community for a certain time. When you became unclean. And one of those was when you came in contact with a corpse. That was an unclean thing. It's not a sin, it's an unclean thing. It's something that necessitates removal from the rest of the community for a time. On the third day after that, there's a special cleansing ritual. And then on the seventh day after that, there's another special cleansing ritual, and then you can rejoin society. And there are a lot of, you know, hygienic reasons for that, but also just the nature of uncleanness and purity. So everyone involved in this funeral who's helping to wrap this body in the cloth and to process that body, to get it up on the board, and everyone who's carrying, even just touching that board, everyone who is carrying that body out has made themselves unclean and is going to have those 7 days of removal, withdrawal from society. But it's worth it to them. This is a way of them showing, you know, look, we're in this with you. We're willing to take this on because we know what a tragedy this is. And this is something that needs to be done. It needs to be dealt with. We will mourn with you. And part of our mourning with you is making ourselves unclean for these 7 days so that your son's body can be buried. Now, Jesus is the random stranger who has just walked up. And he puts his hand out to touch that board, to touch that plank of wood. That simple action that was totally unnecessary for the purpose of actually raising the man from the dead has now made Jesus unclean, and it is something that would normally be viewed as an inconvenience and a hassle when it's for someone that you don't even know. So if Jesus really is just this cruel person who has come up to taunt her about her sorrow and her crying, to say, you know, stop weeping, why on earth would he reach out and touch that board? I think this is Jesus showing in a simple but powerful way, I am lowering myself to your level. And I don't mean like level of power. I mean to your level of emotional state. I'm meeting your sorrow where you are. I'm not telling you, get up, stop being sad, stop being in such a state. And I'm not even just ignoring you as some stranger who's a part of a funeral. I'm meeting your sorrow with compassion. So there's a small way that we do this in our society. We have funeral processions as well, though they tend to be in cars these days. And so we have the procession from the funeral home to the cemetery that most people still do. And a lot of times that has a police escort, and it is tradition in most places. I don't know if it is here. I assume it is here. But it's tradition in most places that when a funeral procession is passing by, that you pull over, that you let them go by. And it's a sign of respect and a sign of compassion for these people who are having a terrible day, who are mourning the loss of someone special to them, that you are pulling over and saying, I'll let you go by, I'll stay out of your way, and I'll give you a little moment of solemnity to show that, you know, I feel for you, even though I don't know you. So that's simple. That's a very small thing that we can do, and it's something that still is a way of being respectful, even of a stranger who is going through a hard time. Jesus is doing something kind of like that, but with higher stakes, because he's got a 7-day unclean period to go through. That's a lot more than just simply stepping aside for a moment or two. So when you combine Jesus' action with his strange statement to stop weeping, it becomes clear that Jesus feels invested in this woman and in her situation. He feels her sorrow as his own, and he wants to help. That's powerful. Because she's a stranger to him. She's not somebody that he has interacted with. She's not somebody who should mean something in particular to him. She's just some woman in some other town who lost a son. You know how many people die every day? Some people like to read the obituaries in the paper all the time. Did you ever get to a day where the obituary section said, nobody died today? No. There's always somebody there. There's always many people there. Many people die every day in our community and all over the world. And it can be easy for us to be callous about that, but Jesus shows how important it is to be compassionate. The second part of this is not just his compassion, not just meeting sorrow with kindness, but also that he shows greater power than the prophets. The prophets, a little weird, but we're going to make this connection. So Jesus had reached out, had touched the bier, and he said, young man, I say to you, arise. And he did. He got up, and he began speaking to his mother. Jesus presented him to her, and all was well. It is an expression of power that Jesus could raise the dead when we are not able to do such a thing? You know, doesn't that give you chills to imagine Jesus saying, "Young man, I say to you, arise"? To us, death is a cavernous, infinite void that separates us from our loved ones. We know that one day it will separate us from everything and everyone that we know here. Its specter looms over us when we are confronted with, you know, disease, with illness, with danger, with old age. We fear it to a certain degree. And some of being a Christian is learning that death is not something to be feared because we have the hope of eternal life. Yet there is still trepidation. There is still this feeling deep within us that death is a scary and, I almost said unnatural thing, but it's not unnatural. That's the thing. It's natural. It's the way that everyone goes. We all die. And there's nothing that we can do to reverse that. And you know that if you've had a loved one die, there's nothing you can do to bring them back. There's nothing you can say. There's no amount of money you can spend. There's no great feat you can accomplish that will bring them back from the dead. Yet Jesus just says, "Young man, arise." And he does. That gives me chills. That's so much power that Jesus so easily raises the dead. You know, from anyone else, that would be an arrogant command, an arrogant statement. But from Jesus, it is a word with power. This young man is alive and well, as if nothing ever happened. There's a comparison we can make to two of the prophets of old, Elijah and Elisha, who had similar experiences and worked similar miracles of raising someone from the dead. And I don't want to go and read through all of these, mainly for the sake of time, and I'm going to summarize them for you. But I've got the references up here on the screen. It's 1 Kings 17 for Elijah and 2 Kings 4 for Elisha. If you'd like to write that down to read and study some more later, you can. I know for me, throughout my life, I have conflated these two a lot and have had to kind of work to get them untangled in my mind as two separate incidents, because they are. And they're important as standalone events, but they're, I think, even more important when you compare them to what Jesus did. So let's talk about Elijah first. In 1 Kings 17, Elijah entered the city of Zarephath in a time of drought. Yet there was a widow who was willing to share her last morsel of food with him. She was hesitant at first. She was in a desperate state. She said, "I only have this last little bit of flour and oil, and I'm going to make one last, little cake of bread. And then my son and I will prepare to die because we have no more food and there is nowhere else to get food." And Elijah asks her to share that with him first and then to make it for herself and for her son. And she does so. And as an expression of faith, as an expression of hospitality as well, she does so. And in return, God supplies her and her household with endless flour and oil. No matter how much of it she used, there was always more in the containers. And so they would not die after all. And Elijah stays with them for some time and lives there with them in their home. Yet the only son of that widow dies anyway from a terrible disease, a terrible illness. We don't know exactly what it was, but he got sick and he died. And his mother, this widow, is in great distress. And in her grief, she blames Elijah. "You've played some cruel trick on me. We were prepared to die, and you saved us. God saved us. For what? Just so that he can die soon from an illness? You know, what kind of cruel trick are you playing on us?" So Elijah pleads with Yahweh again and again. He He kneels down beside the boy, and he gets face to face with him, and he prays to the Lord three times. And finally, God hears and answers. The boy breathes again, and Elijah presents him to his mother alive and well. So obviously some of the details are different, but there's a lot of connection between this story and what Jesus did in Nain. A widow who has lost her only son, and she's in deep distress, but Elijah is able to raise him from the dead. Well, in 2 Kings 4, Elisha has something similar happen. This one's maybe slightly more different than the others, but there's enough connection that I think this is worthwhile to talk about. Elisha is making his circuit throughout the country, as he does all the time, and he frequently passes by Shunem. And a wealthy woman there in Shunem sees an opportunity to offer assistance to a man of God, to offer hospitality. And so she frequently invites him to come in and stay for a time, to be able to eat some bread, to rest from his journey and to continue on. When she realizes how often this happens, she convinces her husband that it would be a good idea for them to build a guest room, basically, for him, that he could always have a place not just to come in for a moment or two, but even to spend the night and to really rest and to be rejuvenated and ready to resume his travels. And the husband doesn't really seem to care. This is very much instigated by her. She's the one who is viewing this as an important thing to do. But he doesn't really care, so she does this, and Elisha takes advantage of this several times. And eventually, through his servant Gehazi, he says, "Is there something that I can do for you in return?" He says, "Could I talk to the king on your behalf or to the commander of the army on your behalf?" Since this woman and her husband were very wealthy, they would have had a very high tax burden to supply the government and the military in that area. And that would have been a large burden for them to deal with. And Elijah had enough respect and enough influence that he's saying, "I could go and talk to them for you and relieve some of that burden as, my way of rewarding you for your hospitality that you have shown me so consistently." And the Shunammite woman says, basically, "Thanks, but no thanks." Actually, what she says literally is, "I dwell among my own people." Essentially, "I am proud of how we are able to support our community and the high burden we have here, a large burden we have financially, is worth it because it betters our community, and we are in a position to do this when others are not." And so she doesn't want this help from Elisha. So Elisha confers with his servant Gehazi and asks, "What can we do to help them? What is it that they actually need?" And Gehazi says, "Well, they have no son, and her husband is old." And so Elisha calls the Shunammite woman to him, and he tells her that she will embrace a son by this time next year. Now, she's hesitant to believe that, but he says, "You can count on it. It will happen." And it does. A year later, she gives birth, and they have a son. Now, the narrative flashes forward some years ahead, and this boy is out in the field with his father, when suddenly he cries out, "Oh, my head, my head." And the father sends him back to the house with his mother, and she holds him in her lap until noon, and the boy just dies. Don't know what happened, but his head suddenly hurt, and then he died. And she's devastated, obviously. And she immediately starts heading to Elisha. She gets on her animal, and she is going just as fast as she can. And Elisha, comes to see what it is that she wants, and she has a very similar reaction that the widow in Zarephath did. She's angry, she's grieving, she's confused, she's betrayed, she kind of blames Elisha on, you know, why did you give me this son? I didn't even ask you for the son. I didn't beg you for this. I had resigned myself to not having a son. You are the one who gave the son to me, and then look, he's dead. Why did you do this? What cruel trick are you playing on me? Elisha doesn't know. Elisha has not heard a word from the Lord on this, but he wants to try to fix it. So he tells Gehazi, take my staff, go to the boy and lay the staff across his body, across his face, and maybe he'll be healed. And Gehazi goes and does that, and that doesn't do anything. So Elisha goes personally and goes up into that room alone with that boy, and like Elijah did, he kneels down beside him. He gets face to face with him, hand to hand with him, and he's praying to the Lord that the boy would be raised. After some time, the boy's skin becomes warm, but he doesn't rouse. And Elisha gets up, and it says he walks in and out like he's pacing. And he goes back and he does the whole thing all over again. Again, face to face, hands to hands, praying to the Lord, asking for God to raise him. And finally the boy wakes up, breathes, and Elisha is able to present him to his mother. So compare these things. Is the lesson here that Elijah and Elisha are only able to just barely work miracles? Like, both of them go to some great effort for their miracle to work, right? Is there, like, a scale for how much, like, religious energy it takes to perform a miracle? Like, no, that's not how that works. This is not a video game. Sorry. Instead, this is showing, one, I think, that this is a very powerful thing that is being done, and that they are needing to show some consistent and persistent, you know, appeal to God for God to answer the prayer. Now, Elijah and Elisha show great power on many different occasions. But, you know, sometimes God doesn't answer our prayer the very first time. Sometimes we have to ask again and again. Sometimes we have to show how important it is to us. And then God eventually answers. But I think the biggest reason why it seems like Elijah and Elisha have to go to so much effort to raise these people from the dead is that it's going to be a really interesting comparison when Jesus has a parallel experience. He also is raising a young man from the dead, yet he does not have to go face to face, hand to hand. He does not have to pray fervently again and again. He does not have to go to all this great effort. He just says, young man, arise. And he does. So what's the message here? Jesus has greater power than the prophets. Jesus has greater power than Elijah and Elisha, considered to be the greatest prophets in the history of Israel. Yet Jesus is able to do what they do and so much more. The people's testimony is fascinating. At the end of the account, they recognize that the impossible has happened before their eyes. They're seized with fear, but they glorify God. Yet, I think they're still just on the precipice of the full realization. Because what they say is, a great prophet has arisen among us. Did you catch that? A great prophet. This is one of the great prophets, like the great prophets in history. But Jesus is not just a great prophet, and that's the point of comparing to Elijah and Elisha. That's the point of Jesus healing the centurion's son without being anywhere near. That's the point of what John the Baptizer's disciples reported to him in prison just a little later in this chapter, when they said the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news preached to them. That's in Luke 7:22. Luke's giving us a narrative here showing that despite what the people said, this is not a great prophet. This is the great prophet. In Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 19, it says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me," this is Moses talking, "a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen, just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, 'Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, or see this great fire anymore, lest I die.' And the Lord said to me, 'They are right in what they have spoken. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him.'" The glory of God upon Horeb was too much for the people to bear. They wanted a mediator. They wanted somebody to stand between them and God. And Moses served that role. But God said that one day there would be a better mediator. A mediator that had the perfection of God and the familiarity and relatability of man. A mediator who could be prophet, priest, and king. That's Jesus. You know, the people in Nain also said, apart from a great prophet has arisen among us, they also said, "God has visited his people." And that was more accurate than they probably realized. God had visited them not just through a great prophet, but God had visited them directly. In John chapter 1, verses 14 through 18, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, 'This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We have seen his glory." You know, the Israelites were scared of that glory on Horeb. And when Jesus came, most people didn't even really recognize that that same glory was there among them. But that's what it was. God had visited his people. Jesus raising the dead in Nain is not just a minor miracle. It's him showing that he has compassion toward the lowly, compassion toward those who are in deep sorrow and who need help. And also that he has greater power than even the greatest prophets. It's a good lesson for us to learn about Jesus, and good for us to see this in such a powerful way. Thank you, brethren and friends. We want to give you the opportunity that if you need to come to Christ and to serve him, to be his disciple, you can do that. You can be baptized for the remission of your sins. And we'll give you the chance to make that need known and to be baptized if that is your desire. Or if you have questions that we can answer, if you have something you would like us to pray for you about, we're happy to do any of that. So please come forward and let us know as together we stand and sing.